Welcome to Being a Girl in an Activist Boys Club. This panel came about after hearing a lot of voices of women who have had very interesting experiences within activist communities and wanted to have more of a voice within those communities. And also so that we can hear the voices of people here. So basically what's going to happen is we're going to have three lovely presenters, and then afterwards we're going to have a discussion, and anyone can feel free to bring up points that they want, try to be respectful and within reason. And we would love to hear from you, love to hear from your individual experiences within groups, because that's what anarchy is all about, is the individual in some ways, like everyone has the right to have a voice and be heard. So we have three presenters today. Naomi Jaffe, who was an activist in the 60s and an activist today. She's involved in the Weather Underground, amongst other things. Diane Krauthammer, who is an amazing organizer, filmmaker, human being, who is with the IWW and NEPAT. And Johanna, who is also involved in the IWW and helped to organize this wonderful book fair. So, if you want to get started, Naomi will.
I'm going to start. Thanks to you guys for organizing the panel. I'm going to try to talk loud enough so that you can hear me, but if you can't, remind me. If you can't hear me, remind me and I'll speak up. We're here because of inequality, a particular kind of inequality, male supremacy. And so I want to give a little history about inequality. And in order to do that, I've got this string on. The string. The string is 40 feet long. And I've made it 40 feet long to represent 4 million years of the history of humans and our human ancestors on the earth. So I want to talk about this history, because if we decide to scrap the proposition that our current culture of North American and European white supremacist domination is the pinnacle toward which the universe has been evolving for billions of years, if we decide to scrap that premise, there may be something that we've learned from these 4 million years of human history. And that's going to be my premise. We don't know a whole lot about the 4 million years of history, but from what we know that for almost all of these 4 million years, humans lived in very small groups of hunters and gatherers. And in those groups, no one had more power or more wealth than anyone else. For most of our 4 million years of history, the groups of hunter-gatherers had greater equality than anything that we have had since. That started to change about 10,000 years ago, different in different places in different parts of the world. About 10,000 years ago, for reasons that are not entirely clear, some of those small societies began to change their mode of production, began the process of men imposing their domination on women, of people accumulating wealth, of some people enslaving and exploiting other people. And those societies that were changing in those ways also began to, through war and conquest, impose their domination on their neighbors. So all that process that began about 10,000 years ago, it was a very violent process. And I just want to give you an idea of what it looks like on this string of human history. Remember I said the string represents, stay with me through the math here. The string represents 4 million years, and so about every 10 feet represents a million years, right? So that means about a foot on the string represents 100,000 years of the history of humans on Earth. So a foot represents 100,000 years. If we're talking about 10,000 years, we're talking about a tenth of a foot. Tenth of a foot, say around an inch and a quarter. The period, say around an inch and a quarter. See it? Can you see this inch and a quarter? The period of the domination of some people over other people is this long in the history of humans on Earth. Look at the string and look at the period of the culture of domination. domination and tell me that domination is inherent in human nature. Okay. That process, that gradual 10,000, sorry, that gradual 10,000 violent year process is the process of the imposition of male and class supremacy on the people of Europe. So that represents this little inch and a quarter. The imposition of white supremacy actually began with the expansion of the European culture of domination about 500 years ago. You can almost not see it on the street, white supremacy. About 500 years, it's less than a tenth of an inch. If you're sitting in the back, you won't be able to see it. A tenth of an inch for that culture, white supremacy, that so defines the inequality in our world today. If, and this is not to minimize the level of suffering and injustice that's represented by these cultures of inequality, it's only to say that if we look at the history of humans without condescension, then there's something to be learned from our human ancestors. There's something to be learned from the history of people on Earth about the possibilities of something different. Now, these 10,000 years of the imposition of domination were incredibly brutal. All 10,000 of every one. The level of brutality that was required to impose the domination of some people over the people was unspeakable. And what I wanted to say about it, I wanted to give you just a little sense from the earliest descriptions that I've been able to find of this process of imposing domination. This is from the Old Testament. I'm going to read you a little passage from the Old Testament, from the book of Joshua. A lot of the Old Testament is about the conquest of the lands of the Middle East by a people who worshipped a male god, conquering people who worshipped female gods. So it's actually part of our history of the imposition of male supremacy. This is from the book of Joshua, and it's a description of the destruction of the city of Ai, which happened, this is about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, we're talking. And it came to pass, when Israel had made an end of slaying all the inhabitants of Ai in the field, even in the wilderness wherein they pursued them, and they were all fallen by the edge of the sword until they were consumed, then all Israel returned to Ai and smote it with the edge of the sword. And all that fell that day, both of men and women, were 12,000, even all the people of Ai. For Joshua drew not back his hand wherewith he stretched out the javelin until he had utterly destroyed all the inhabitants of Ai. Only the cattle and spoil of that city Israel took for a prey unto themselves, according unto the word of the Lord, which he commanded Joshua. So Joshua burnt Ai and made it a heap forever, even a desolation unto this day. And the king of Ai, he hanged on a tree until eventide. Skipping a couple of thousand years. Did you want me to stay? I thought you were going to let me go over. I'm not going to do it in 4 minutes. I thought we decided we could go a little over. It's always in here. I'm not going to do it. skipping a couple thousand years, this biblical culture was the forerunner of the European culture, which in the 15th century spread its destruction to the rest of the world by violence. We're told that European culture succeeded in dominating the whole world because it was more innovative, more advanced, morally and technologically, more creative, more bold. Actually, the opposite is true. The Europe of the 15th century was the Europe of the Inquisition, a place of unspeakable torture, people being burned alive and quartered, a place of disease and death and cruelty and poverty and despair. And it was this, out of this imbalance, a disease and death and poverty growing out of these centuries of growing inequality, of growing imposition of inequality. And it was out of this imbalance and this sickness that Europe was driven to the conquest, to spread the culture of disease and death to the rest of the world. This global spread of cruelty and misery is the root, and it's the definition to this day of white supremacy. This is the era that we still live in. the entire history of these thousands of years of the violent spread of the culture of domination is filled with a level of suffering and cruelty and torture that is beyond imagination. You could read it for years and not even scratch the surface. From the burning of heretics in the Inquisition to the agonies inflicted on the prosperous people of the New World by the Spaniards, to the 400-year history of the enslavement of Africans, to the waterboarding inflicted on Filipinos who resisted U.S. imperial domination at the turn of the 20th century, to the massacres and tiger cages of Vietnam, to this day when our young people from our country are bombing and burning and raping the people of Iraq, and when in the secret prisons of the CIA around the world, people made desperate by torture are trying to take their own lives by smashing their heads against the stone walls of the prison. Every minute of every day, this happens as we speak, every minute of every day of the domination of male and white supremacy is filled with this level of suffering. And I'm telling you this not in order to bring despair, but the opposite. Because there's only been one thing that's been stronger than this culture of death and domination for these 10,000 years, and that's the resistance to it. When you read the level of brutality and violence, you can't imagine how the world and the beings in it have survived to this day. And the only reason that they have is the strength of the resistance. Every single place, every single instance, every single land where any of this happened, people to whom it happened resisted with every fiber of their being. And I would like to argue that every single one of those resistances was a successful resistance. Some of them were, that every one of them, and that collectively, they have succeeded in saving our Earth. That some of those resistances were obviously successful. Enslaved Africans, over 400 years of sabotage and armed uprising, eventually were the reason that slavery ended, not because Lincoln signed a piece of paper, but because of that ongoing resistance. The Vietnamese, one of the poorest and most technologically underdeveloped people in the world, defeated the mightiest military power the world has ever known. But even those resistances that appear to have failed, I would argue that none of them failed utterly, that every one of them left a trace, a remnant, an inspiration, a source of strength. These are the shoulders on which we build today. And so the conversation that we came here to have today, the conversation about how we as women can survive and thrive against the tide of male supremacy in our movement, this conversation is our chapter in the history of resistance and oppression in the history of the world. This is our moment. This is the moment that we add, that we contribute to the history of resistance. So what I would say is that our movements of resistance are... That the world cannot survive without our movements of resistance. And our movements of resistance cannot survive without confronting the inequalities within them. So that taking on sexism, racism, and homophobia within our movements is not a matter of political correctness. It's a matter of survival. It's a matter of life and death. As Audre Lorde says, the master's tools can never dismantle the master's house. So a couple of specific things about this particular resistance, our resistance as women to male supremacy within our movements. I don't believe that it's women's job to educate men or change them, any more than I think that it's people of color's job to educate and change white people around racism. And so, to me, this is a conversation among women. And to say that it's a conversation among women is not to say that I think that we are responsible for or to blame for sexism, but only to say that in the dance of oppressed and oppressor, the only steps that we can change are our own. And when we change those steps, the dance changes profoundly. And so how do we change the steps in the dance? If radical culture is defined by machismo and posturing, who is it that's defining it that way? Can conversations like the one that we're having here today bring out, create our ability as women to define it differently for ourselves and for each other? What if we don't try to convince men to act differently? What if we don't play? Will they play without us? If we respect each other, then we will be respected. Our women's culture, our women's ways of knowing, our women's experiences our women's wisdom, are honored and respected by us, by each other, then they will be honored and respected. However, I would like to say that it's obviously it's not that simple. And the reason that it's not that simple is that the differences out there, the differences of power and privilege, the differences of class and race and sexual identity, those differences exist among us as women. And without confronting them, among us as women, we can't confront them in the world, and vice versa. Our ability to confront inequality out there in the world and in here, each one strengthens the other, and what's out there is in here. It's the same fight. And so, I read another quote that I want to read you. As my friend Barbara Smith says, feminism is the political theory and practice that struggles to free all women, women of color, working class women, poor women, disabled women, lesbians, old women, as well as white, economically privileged, heterosexual women. Anything less than this vision of total freedom is not feminism, but merely female self-aggrandizement. Our ability to build alliances with each other depends on our continually confronting in the world those inequalities that make our life chances unequal. And our movements of social justice depend, our ability to make those alliances determines our effectiveness in our movements for social justice. And the effectiveness of our movements of social justice determines our ability to continue the history of resistance, which up until now has been the reason that our world has survived. Our mutual survival depends on our ability to overturn inequality and injustice inside and outside of our movements. Just before I end, I just want to say, while I have the floor, because I'm not planning to take it for any longer at all, that my own particular piece of work in the world and working around social justice has been in support for political prisoners, in particular for support for Mumia Abu-Jamal, who has just had one more unjust and unreasonable decision from our federal court system. There will be a demonstration in support of Mumia's freedom a week from today in Philadelphia, and I have flyers. Gwen has some more flyers. By the end, we'll pass
tickets downstairs.
Tickets for my bus tickets at the table. Thanks. Thank you.
So I'm going to talk about generally pulling feminism out of the trap of identity politics and out of the trap of liberal feminism and into the working class social struggles. What I'm going to be talking about is that capitalism doesn't need sexism to function, but it does depend on class exploitation. Therefore, while it's important and necessary to fight against class exploitation to defeat capitalism, sexism still exists in this fight. So really the only way to fight all forms of oppression is to incorporate anti-patriarchal principles into the class struggle movement. So basically, feminism within the anarchist movement tends to be based individualistically, while anarcho-feminists offer temporary solutions, which are like birth control alternatives, safe spaces, which are all very, very important, very, very necessary for us to survive. These practices don't attack the root issues of gender and class oppression. At the same time, this is a semi-flawed strategy because although many of us non-white males experience oppression, we're looking for alternatives and support, it's still important to fight against patriarchy in the larger class struggle because capitalism depends on exploitation to function. It doesn't depend on sexism. It actually adapts to women's changing roles. Yet within capitalism, sexism must exist to some extent to maximizing profits. This is due to our biological ability to bear children, which in turn leads to our inability to work full time. We'll get unpaid maternity leave, that sort of thing. We have a certain economic vulnerability, and that makes us never quite able to achieve full equality with men within the capitalist system. In addition to the role in our workplace, sexist and gender roles and attitudes are perpetuated throughout the corporate media. We have objectified and submissive roles. This is due to the larger system at play, and really, again, can't be combated with these mandated reforms. Instead, it can be combated with fighting the system that perpetrates these attitudes. So, what would an anarchist feminism look like? It's hard to say, because the class struggle movement tends to be white male dominated, and due to this, feminist issues tend to be brushed aside as secondary to the class struggle. Some have what the worker solidarity movement in Ireland call a class reductionist viewpoint, which basically views feminism as divisive, holding that sexism will automatically vanish once capitalism and class society is abolished.
Magically.
This is an avoidant argument, and it sounds ridiculous, but people make it. It's actually surprising, too, that it seems to be an avoidant crowd since it's primarily women. And therefore, I think it's visually obvious that people are really afraid to deal with this issue. Too many times we experience sexism within our own working class movements, within our own anarchist struggles. It's important. We're fighting a larger battle. And our oppression as a woman is brushed aside. In this context, our so-called comrades get away with macho attitudes. And if we as women don't toughen up and speak aggressively and twice as loud in meetings and in actions, wherever, we become ignored and eventually alienated and eventually leave. And this has happened too many times. These macho attitudes lead to an acceptance of things like sexual assault in our communities, and at the worst, and at best, continued lack of female involvement in these important struggles. So, basically, these issues affect us all. I don't have a solution. Well-facilitated meetings, that's cool, but it's not easy. It's something that people need to keep in mind as they're working within larger social movements. And I have copies of an article called Feminism, Class, and Anarchism that the Worker Solidarity Movement in Ireland put out. And it's only 50 copies. There's 150 people here, so if you can access it online or get the copy of the URL down, you can do that.
Where do you access it online?
If you look at the thing, I could actually give you the link after.
Okay.
So I just want to build on everything that Naomi and Diane both said. I think that what I mainly want to focus on is Naomi spoke very broadly and gave us like a grounding history and like what leads us to where we are, and Diane spoke more specifically about what goes on and how it happens. I want to talk even more specifically about like as individuals in these situations that Naomi and Diane described, like what do we do with that? So I'm mainly interested in how do we make activism. I mean, we're all here. I'm assuming maybe some of you just showed up, but anyone who's been here all day long can see, like, who... I mean, I know that, like, this event isn't representative of activism or organizing, and a lot of activism and organizing looks incredibly different. But, for example, something called the New York City Anarchist Book Fair, if we're talking about, like, organizing within anarchism, this is who it brings out. This is who our community is as New York City anarchists. largely young white men. And so within organizing as anarchists in New York City, you interact largely with young white men. And that's fine. There's nothing inherently wrong with young white men, but you know, what is it about organizing as anarchists in New York City, which I'm sure really translates to all other situations, what is it that either A, women aren't, and people of color, but here we're specifically going to be addressing all women, but men of color too. What is it that makes this environment and activism not inviting or not welcoming or not appealing to people who aren't young white men? And or women who do get involved, why do they drop out? Why do they not stay involved? What about this scene or this community or this, you know, our organizing campaigns is uninviting and then dismissive or rejecting of women's voices? So I'm kind of interested in the pros and cons of how women organize and how women do activism. A lot of women are involved in mixed gender organizations, and I think that that's mainly what I'm going to address. But there's also women who get involved in, you know, rejecting the bullshit of patriarchy and the sexism that is just recreated in our alternative societies, activism communities. And so they form women-only organizations that are, you know, comfortable or safe for women to do activism and be heard and valued. And then a lot of women don't have any community and they just work solo. They work on their own projects and they maybe interact with people here and there. But I mean, there's pros and cons to all those approaches. But the bottom line is if you're going to be doing anything, you probably have to interact with, you know, dude activists at some point. how do you do that? I have more questions than I have answers. I don't really think I have any answers, but I'm really interested in turning this forum that we have now, we have this space, we have this time to address these issues, and I'm really interested in anybody who showed up today, hearing why they showed up and what drew them here and what they think the answers are or what their ideas are or what their questions are. But some of my questions are, you know, why do we recreate so much of what we're trying to oppose? If we're opposed to capitalism and if we're opposed to consumerist America, patriarchal America, racist America, you know, everything that we see is wrong and we're in opposition to that, why are we recreating so much of it in our alternative? You know, why are we carrying over the culture of patriarchy to activism? And why are capitalist traits, character traits, things like aggression or forcefulness or an unwillingness to compromise, why are all those same traits valued in activism? And what happens to people who aren't willing or aren't able to or aren't interested in doing those things to get heard? What Diane was saying about, well-facilitated meetings can help because a lot of times, in order to be, if you're the only woman or if you're one of the only women in the meeting, or even if you're, there's a ton of women in the meeting, that doesn't mean that, those women are being heard, because oftentimes it's the loudest, most forceful, most aggressive, you know, not listening to others, you know, person in the room who tends to be a guy who's, you know, dominating the space. Even if he's the only person in there, you know, like that, he's dominating. And, that means that women are not being heard. So why are we doing that? Why are we letting that happen, and how can we change that? I'm going to skip some stuff. I also kind of have a question about, I know that, this is not a new issue. This is something that's been around for as long as resistance, as long as oppression has been around, as long as the resistance to oppression has been around. You know, as long as cultures of patriarchy have been around, gender roles have been around, and as long as we're recreating cultures of patriarchy within our activism, we're also recreating gender roles within our activism. So this is not a new idea, I bet, to anybody in the room, but, if we think about the organizations that we're involved with, are we still doing things in a given meeting that you go to, whatever your organization is, who facilitates the meeting? Is it a man or a woman? Who takes the notes? Is it a man or a woman? So who is responsible for reporting the ideas of the people who are, you know, responsible for having ideas? 9 times out of 10, it's a guy speaking and a woman writing. It's, very secretarial and, you know, it's just like thinking about like these things that still happen, that like who's in the support role and who's in the leadership role. And how do we like A, recognize that so that we can raise consciousness around it, and then B, like call it out and address it. So that we say things like how like we have a revolving chair, or why don't we hear from somebody that we haven't heard from before? Which are all like really anarchist ideas, the ideas of hearing all the voices. So going back to like the idea that like there are certain traits like aggression or forcefulness or not being willing to compromise or not being willing to listen to other people that are valued, the flip side to that is that people who are not socialized to be aggressive and forceful, which oftentimes tend to be women, or people who have no interest in being aggressive and forceful, because I don't think the solution to sexism within activism is to have women learn how to be more of an asshole, you know? So, like, the flip side to not hearing people who aren't willing to be assholes is that a lot of people who tend to be women are, their organizing and their activism, their skills, and everything that they're bringing to the table is all being undervalued, disrespected, and ignored, and not heard. Which, even if you don't give a shit about women, like, if you care about the movement, or you care about the organization that you're in, or you care about, like, the issue that you're working on, that should matter to you, because anytime that you're, you know, whatever you're working on is not inclusive, and you see, like, huge gaps in like who's being represented, who's working on it, if you think that issue is important enough to like be addressed, then it should be important to everybody. And chances are the issue is important. Maybe it's just the way that you're addressing it that's like unappealing to like whole sections of people. So just like some awareness about that. And again, I don't necessarily have the answers for how to solve all these things. Yeah, I'm sorry to disappoint if that was what you were looking for. Also, I'm kind of interested in, like, what tools are used to exclude women from decision-making and leadership within activism. And I'm using the word tools, like, really specifically because I don't think these things are accidental. Maybe they're conscious decisions on some people's part, and maybe they're not. But either way, it's systemic. It's not just accidentally, you know, all of these organizations are dominated by, like, straight white men. Like, oops, how'd that happen? So I think that there are really, like, even if we're not aware of them, they're still dangerous and they're still going on. And if, whether we're aware of them or not, we need to be aware of them. And then after we have awareness, we need to be working to change them. So, like, maybe just brainstorming about, like, in your own organization, what is it that, you know, that, like, maintains certain people in leadership roles and in decision-making roles. And I think some examples that I've been able to come up with, just in brainstorming, are things like security culture, where, you know, if you don't already know somebody, or if they don't know somebody whom you know, like, within activism, because there's a lot of, I mean, security culture came about for a good reason, which is protecting ourselves, but the downside to that is that if you're not already an insider in that really special club, then you're not getting in. So, like, how do we balance the need to protect ourselves and be secure with being inclusive and inviting people who haven't historically been a part of or been welcome at the table?
Well, if you use it as an excuse to exclude people, so it's really somewhat secure.
Yeah. So Karina makes a good point that sometimes it's actually consciously and insidiously used to exclude people whose voices we don't want at the table. It's just to say that, like, well, we don't really know you, and it's like an acceptable excuse. The same thing could be said about, like, inexperience, that when you're trying to do something, when you're trying to put something together, you know, everyone who's here and does any kind of organizing knows, like, you know, we're on deadlines, it's like, there's things that matter, we've got to get, like, 500 things done yesterday, and so what if we want the people who have the most experience doing it, so they know what they're doing, we know we can rely on them, we know they've done it before. The problem with that is that it doesn't develop new leadership. So you have to take, I mean, if we value the sustainability of these movements, and if we value the growth of the movement, we have to invest time in developing new leadership. Let me see. What else did I want to say? Along those lines, we have to recruit women activists if we want to change the gender breakdown of what goes on. Beyond, like, drawing more women into organizing, a lot of women come into organizing. It's not like women haven't heard of these things. It's not like women don't realize this shit's fucked up, you know? Like, this isn't, you know, it doesn't take a man to realize these things. But, like, a lot of times women drop out of organizations. And, you know, I think that goes back to, like, the you know, the politics of things that go on in those organizations. So you need to, like, whatever your organization is and wherever you're coming from, you know, maybe taking some self-reflection time in that organization as individuals, but also collectively as the organization, to, like, and to notice, like, who's kind of falling by the wayside, who's kind of dropping out. Like, and a lot of times people don't really blaze out and explain all the reasons why they're dropping out. They just kind of fade away. So, which is dangerous, because then that leaves the space for people to not be accountable for things that they're doing that are driving people away. Also, I'd be interested in asking the audience and, like, hearing more about, and having more of a dialogue about, like, how different groups of women and different individual women experience sexism, because it's not, like, the way that Naomi and Diane said, to, I'm agreeing with them, that, like, it's not just about, you know, liberal, wealthy, straight white women, and, you know, that's not the definition of, like, feminism, and the oppression of those women, while it's interesting and, you know, worth addressing, is not the definition of sexism. And along those lines, I'd be interested in I want to learn more about, and I hope maybe some of you can bring some of that to this conversation, I want to know more about how different women, as individuals or from different populations and groups, like, are addressing these same things, because women experience oppression, but we don't experience it uniformly, the same way that we don't experience privilege uniformly, and we don't deal with it uniformly. So, I guess I can wrap up there. Got more. There's always more to say.
We have about a little less than 40 minutes left, and within those 40 minutes, we would like to hear from all of you. If you have any questions, if you have any statements, if you want to talk about your experience, please share. One of the things, before we do that, though, I would like to set a couple of ground rules. One, there is someone who's videotaping here right now, so anything that you say is going to be public, even if there wasn't someone videotaping. This is a large, you know, audience of people. While it would be...
I just wanted to say that my name's Jennifer, and I'm working on a documentary film about the early days of feminist radicalism. And so I'm very interested in this conversation, which is sort of a reflection of this continuing process, because the early women's liberation movement really grew out of women's frustration with the left. And so here we are having the same conversation again. And we actually have Naomi Jaffe here, who was, you know, part of an early women's liberation group, and others possibly as well in the room. So it's sort of a conversation about, you know, what hasn't changed, what has changed, what can we learn from the past. So I just wanted to ask people, I would love to be able to video this, and if you're comfortable with me filming you, I could film it, and if you're not and you ask a question, I'll just turn the camera off during your question. And I'll try not to get people on the side. I'll just try to get the person who's asking the question. Is that cool with people? Okay.
So, I mean, that said, it is a large audience of people, though, just to kind of be aware of that. If you have something that you really don't want other people to repeat, you can say that before you say what you're going to say, but it doesn't guarantee that someone else isn't going to hear it. Because while I would like to believe that everyone here is trustworthy, it's a really big group of people, which is great. The other is, don't dismiss what anyone else has to say. And please be respectful of the people who are speaking around you. And be aware of how much you're speaking. And while being aware of how much you're speaking, try to stay aware of, you know, who's speaking, who's getting to speak, and your gender as you are speaking. So.
Can I answer?
Okay.
Can I just add one thing? We've already said what we have to say. So primarily, don't ask us questions. We're interested. I think what's useful here is for people to have a conversation and give your own views and experiences rather than directing more questions to us. We've already talked too much.
And also, I also want to hear from like the males in the audience too, not just the females. Like, I know it's kind of weird to be surrounded by mostly girls, which is how you should feel. But I still definitely want to hear the male opinions too. So don't be shy to speak up. Don't feel like intimidated. We're not here to like attack anyone. You know.
Women who don't speak up.
Yes.
Great. Oh, great. Well, first of all, I want to say, Joanne, thank you for putting together a great panel. It's just an honor to sit here. I was just saying it's a real honor to be sharing space here with these incredible women activists. With the idea of, in your claim, Diane, promoting our own brand of anarchist feminism. I mean, I think that's really what we're trying to evolve, is like, what's going to work, what's really radical, and as anarchists, I think we should be concerned with forms of domination, whether it's based on race or gender or class. Anarchism is about not dominating and exploiting people. It's about not having power over people. It's not necessarily about not having power. You have personal powers. You have powers collective. You really need to learn how to use that power to confront injustice. So it's not about not taking power. You want to be powerful. But it's about not using your power over other people. But I think it's this horrible problem that women are pretty consistently dismissed and marginalized, and it's a very painful experience when your voice just doesn't count as much because of what you look like or your gender. And I think that, I don't know if this is the answer, but an answer to that, which from my personal experience, is that you can't just be submissive to that when you can confront, inequality. You have to kind of confront it. And there's so many historical examples. This thing of how Sojourner Truth was kept from speaking out, and how she demanded audience, and like this black slave woman, oh, how dare you, you know. But she did, and there's so many examples of women just taking power, and I think we have to remember those examples. And it's really, when people drop out because they just had enough of shit, it's a loss for the movement. It's a loss for the individual, but you need that talent, you know? And it's a pattern. It's not just you, oh, I feel bad, this is happening to me. No, this is a pattern. This happens to a lot of people. And I feel like encouraging each other and is important. You need some confidence to realize that this should be confronted. And we live in a media with a culture and a media that is extremely patriarchal. We have to be careful about not internalizing those messages. I mean, we go out there in New York City here. I mean, women's body is constantly objectified and pimped, like, to sell for profit, and constantly. You can argue that capitalism is pimping everybody, but in terms of using women's bodies and appropriating them to the relationship, capitalism, I think, definitely benefits from the unpaid domestic labor of women and unpaid child care, and you're giving birth to something that's eventually going to be labor to be exploited. And so there's different ways in which coercive capitalism is definitely a sexism. We have an interest in abolishing capitalism, you know. And you talked about identity. I feel like we all have identities, perhaps multiple identities, and those differences should be okay. And that unity isn't necessarily the same as sameness. We're not all trying to be the same. That would be boring. But we can maybe strive towards unity because we are in a common struggle, and recognizing that common struggle is really pretty critical, strategically speaking. I just want to say something about aggression, though, because I don't feel like aggression is necessarily the domain of men. I feel like women can be aggressive. I'm not talking about being an asshole, but I'm talking about self-determination and self-reliance, knowing that you can stand up for yourself and take care of yourself. There's this movie that I really like. It's called Kill Bill, Volume 1. I love this thing about Kill Bill because the female lead, okay, is a woman. It's not a man. She's very independent and self-reliant. And I'm not necessarily promoting violence, but it just in Hollywood, most of the time, women are just a secondary character, the sexual object, and that's pretty much the only role that's acceptable for women. So the movie kind of turned a lot of things on its head, and it's just like that Sleeping Beauty myth. You're kind of unconscious, and the rapist prince comes along and takes advantage of your unconsciousness. And in that movie, there's a scene where she was supposed to be unconscious, and the rapist comes and leans over to kiss her, and she, like, rips his tongue out and kills him, and It was kind of the rebirth. Well, there's metaphors in there. But anyway, I just thought there's a militant feminist kind of thing with but anyway, the idea was supporting, I was wondering where this was going, but supporting our own brand of anarchist feminism is really what I was getting at, and that could be an exciting imaginative process, and always just have compassion, because people suffer from race clash and gender oppression simultaneously, and so we just keep that in mind. But thanks for coming and sharing those thoughts. Really appreciate it. Get organized so you can support each other when shit happens, you know?
Yes.
Me?
Yeah. Oh, great. Okay.
My name is Fran Love, and right now I do a feminist program on WBAI, the only feminist program on WBAI. It's called the Joy of Resistance Multicultural Feminist Radio. It's on the fourth Thursday of every month, and I have about 13 little pieces of paper. But the reason I'm doing this program comes directly out of my experience in the anarchist movement of the Lower East Side, the squatter movement, which I spent 10 to 15 years out on the streets about, you know, which I got involved to save my neighborhood from gentrification. And I was a feminist way before that. But I got into this movement, and I was, like, amazed. I couldn't believe that 30 years after the feminist movement, the level of sexism, the level of total male domination, I was really thrown away by it. And it caused me to change my direction, really, because I was more of a housing organizer at that point, and decide that it wasn't, quote, safe, you know, in every level for women to be active in these movements and have more feminism to be used. And I got a program on a pirate radio station talking about that, and then I got some chops, and then I, you know, WBAI, and now I work on this program. Okay, when I first did, just a couple of quick examples, because I think we should be real specific about what, can I look at my face, people?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, thank you. Just a couple of quick examples. As soon as I got into this movement, we do a lot of soapbox speaking in Tompkins Square Park. Anyone remember that? So I know some. I see a couple of squatter faces here. And I would notice that as soon as a woman, when the rare woman got up to speak, all of a sudden the men would decide they had a lot to talk to each other about. And, you know, they would call the attention. So here's something. Woman isn't, you know, she's not being stopped from speaking. But nobody, it's obvious no one thinks what she has to say is important. I noticed that when women spoke up at meetings, and this was the case with me, because I had some feminist background, and I was older than most of these guys, so I wasn't like as afraid as some of the younger women were. And I'd get up to speak, and I really wouldn't speak as long as the biggest honchos on the scene, but I would always be accused of dominating the meetings, even though if you looked at the clock, you'd see that I didn't. I mean, this has happened over and over again. And then I began to read studies about how women are perceived as speaking longer than men. By women and men, when we speak for the same time, you know, I used to call this male attention to women deficit disorder. I made a shtick about it on the program. I called it the science report, and I made up all these things with diseases to try to get the point across. Let me see. I'll just cut to the chase, because I know everyone's got examples. But I remember I was, you know, calling marches. I got to be an activist, and I loved anarchism for that reason, because I didn't have to go up through a lot of bureaucracy. You know, if I had a good idea, I could get some people together, call the demonstration, and people would kind of vote with their feet. So I got leadership experience I hadn't had before. Now, you know, the wonderful things about organizing an anarchist. But I just lost my place. I remember this scene where there were all these guys who were sort of taller than me, and they were like the big leaders, and they were all conferring with each other on what to do in some given crisis about a squat being evicted. And I had, by this time, done a lot of stuff, so I certainly should have had the cred to be part of the discussion. And I remember kind of, hey, they're all taller than me, and I couldn't get into it. It was just that moment that kind of encapsulates all the other moments, you know, that seems to symbolize it all. And all these guys wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't say they were particularly sexist, but they were, and they were acting it all the time, okay. And it was exacerbated by the fact that it was a very floating, people were coming in and out all the time. There wasn't like a center that could enforce anything. And I know that's anathema to anarchists, but I have to say that that was really part of the problem. Okay, so anyway, I've told you how that made me, what I did with that. But I also want to just tell you a little bit from what I know about history, which is that it wasn't until women organized an independent women's movement that a lot of the left male party suddenly started to get platforms about women's issues. It took that to get me leverage. And I believe that everybody should encourage that. Along with mixed movements, there'd be an independent feminist movement. Because that's your retreat place. That's where you can, when you want to say fuck you to the whole thing, you have some place to go. And just knowing that gives you strength. That's just one reason. Another thing that's needed is at least a women's caucus. The thing I noticed on the Lower East Side about the younger women was they weren't really sticking together in any sort of solidarity on these issues. They were afraid of looking bad. You're always about to be accused of betraying your movement, which is already under attack if you out these problems. So I'm just going to try to wrap it up. That's what I really want to say. There's got to be women meeting, doing the equivalent of consciousness raising, which is where you just, each woman talks about what she's personally experiencing, and then you put it together, and you start to see your common situation. And there's got to be from that action where women act in a united way. And that's hard for us because we're taught to have contempt for each other and ourselves. So we really have to break that down. Okay, she's giving me the signal.
She's right.
But we get out of that by acting together and taking those risks. Thanks.
I'm keeping a stack of people who are raising their hands, so you get to go next. Still keep your hand raised if you want to speak, and I'm keeping you on the stack, so.
Okay.
All right.
Joe.
No, you're not you. Sit down.
I'm not going to stand up. I've been involved in activism for the past 6 years, and what I find problematic about certain things that have been said in this workshop is using words like letting, saying that, you know, why are women letting men be the one dominating the conversation or dominating the meeting? Like, I have never let a man take that away from me. I have never let a man do that. Like, and it's really, really hard for me to hear that because, you know, for the past 6 years, I have constantly called men on their privilege. And, you know, if we're all activists and we're all about solidarity, it's about calling someone out on their privilege. And regardless, time and time again, I said, you know, you really have to work on sharing a conversation. You really have to work on respecting other women in the room. Like, you have a lot of solidarity with your male friends. You know, you've made politics very masculinated. And that has been, you know, problematic for me as a woman. But, you know, I've never let someone do that. And someone saying that to me is like someone using words like letting. Like, I've never let any man take that away from me. And there was, at another point, someone saying that women should be more aggressive in meetings and women should try to make more of an active role. Like, I've always been an active role part of any type of meeting. I've always held my ground. And the root of the problem isn't my accountability as a woman. It's not my job to stand up and, like, I'm not an aggressive person. I've always tried to keep really calm about politics and be really calm about being in a community that's supposed to be about solidarity. Part of being a part of solidarity, whether in race issues, class issues, sexuality issues, transgendered issues, you know, you have to be in solidarity with each other and willing to deal with your privilege. And my problem, mostly in the women's movement or me being a part of any type of radical community, is the fact that people are really hard on themselves to deal with their privilege. And it's not my job, you know, it's not my job to be more aggressive. It's a man's job to learn how to deal with their privilege and learn how to take a step down and learn how to take a step back. Like, my issue, I've been a part of various different things. It's like, I see so many women organizing. I think that a lot of women have been organizing recently. Like, I go to Hunter College and I'm a huge part of the social groups there. I'm a huge part of everything that's going on. I make myself really, like, known, and it's not my job to be aggressive. It's not my job to try to monopolize any type of meeting. It is also a man's job to own up to his privilege and deal with the fact that they need to take a step back. And it's really hard for me, like, to sit in any type of workshop and be told, like, you should be more aggressive. It's like, I am really, like, I make my voice heard and I try to help people deal with their privilege. I feel like a big part of why I feel activism in certain aspects is so male-dominated is because, in my experience, men who want to be allies about feminism are so easy to owning my struggle, are so easy to owning the fact that, you know, like, patriarchy is a really awful thing, and the fact that sexism is so inherent is really awful, and, like, you know, the fact that
you know, abortion is still seen as, like, really, really the fact that even in an activist community, like, it's really seen as, like when women sweep around or women are promiscuous, that, you know, it's still problematic. The fact that all of those things are happening around me, you know, they're so, like, it's so easy for them to own my struggle in a way where, you know, no one should be objectifying me, no one should be grabbing your butt, street harassment is awful, and they can sing songs about it and write books about it and sit at my meeting and say what they want to say about it, but, like, men really need to learn how to take a step back and deal with their privilege. It's not my job to call you out, it's your job to deal with your privilege. Like, I don't know how else to say that. Like, you can't own my oppression, you can't own my struggle, you can talk about it, but a part of being an activist community is dealing with your own personal struggle, with your own personal experience, and dealing with the fact that you do have privilege and you need to learn how to deal with that. And in almost every community I've been a part of, women have called men out. And I've been part of a really strong women's collective on Long Island that have called various men out in our activist community. And I've been tokenized into a woman who's taking herself too seriously and, like, the bitch police. And don't be derogatory about me. Like, I have worked so hard to try to deal with my privilege and have tried to rationally deal with my struggle and try to help understand, like, why you want to be an ally and how I can trust you to deal with your privilege and me accepting you into my community. I don't think it's my job to be aggressive. I think it's a man's job to step down when he has to deal with his privilege. Thank you.
So I wanted to respond to that. Real quick. I just want to point out, like, it is really frustrating when you go through meeting after meeting after meeting, calling people out and like saying, like, okay, you're being patriarchal, you know, and it's like it just doesn't have any effect. But at the same time, I think we have to also be aware that we are in this together, and, like, a lot of, like, the guys that we're working with, like, these are character traits that they were socialized into, that they were, like, that were instilled in them just in the way that, that, you know, females have a lot, like, maintain a lot of, like, our gender roles, too. So, I think we have to recognize that a lot of these, our male comrades are honestly trying to fight this, and I'm trying to not be very, you know, be antagonistic. Like, I'm trying to, like, work with people, and it can be really, really frustrating because it's like it doesn't get through most of the time, but sometimes it does. And I think as long as we maintain like conversation and we stay in our groups and we don't just fall out and stop working in these causes that we care about, I think that's what we, like, that's my opinion, like, that's what we need to do.
Mind if I respond to you? I do work with a lot of men. I do work really hard in doing that. By no means am I saying to be antagonistic, and I am in solidarity with a lot of men, and as much as that is socially inherent in part of them, also part of them being socially inherent about their gender traits is they have a privilege that I don't. That is part of their social construction. That is part of something they have to deal with. I've been more than open. You can ask any of my friends who are here, like any of my ex's friends. I've been more than open in talking about it. I've been very calm about it. I just think it's really hard to convict women and to, like, and this isn't my experience. My experience is how I've experienced activism. This is my personal experience in politics and activism. And I think it's unfair for, like, that may be your experience, and I totally understand that, but I work very hard with men in dealing with their responsibility and their accountability in an activist community, and by no means am I trying to promote, like, fuck you, like, you have privilege. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is I don't think it's fair for you to sit there and convict, like, to tell women that they should be more aggressive when, if you're going to say that, you should also say, and those men have to take a step down. Like, I have my gender role, like, I have been born my gender construction, and yes, it's all inherently social, but, like, I've had oppression handed on my plane that wasn't my choice. And yeah, privilege is a part of their choice, and their gender construction was a part of their choice,
but they still have an upper hand in something I never will. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with them about it, and I've been very calm about it, but if you're going to convict women and tell them you have to be more aggressive, you also have the accountability as a woman who's speaking about these experiences to say, and men need to step, like, take a step down and deal with your privilege. And that's what I'm saying.
You're here.
So, I've given out numbers, starting Eugene is, well, I happen to know his name, is number one. If after that, the number that I've given you corresponds to when you can speak. So just keep track, count, and be respectful. We also have about 15 minutes left. We might stretch over, but please be concise.
Johanna began the talk.
Can you speak up?
Okay, Johanna, at the beginning, said that you know, men don't, what is it? Male privilege, you know, just, yeah, I just wanted to talk to the sort of socially programmed male privilege, and the problem lies very often not in men who dismiss feminism as some kind of bourgeois white thing. There's a big problem with men who consider themselves feminists. When we take away the feminist, we read a lot of theory. Very often we assume that we've just been socially programmed. I'm afraid to say that that's not the case. Every once in a while, I catch myself in socially programmed thinking. It's the autopilot we all fall back on. It's the autopilot that we fall back on no matter what our privilege or, for that matter, our source of oppression is. I think it's very important. You can't, like, second-guess yourself with everything you say and everything you think. That's why we have to help each other along and don't be open to constructive criticism. And the problem with a lot of us men who consider ourselves feminists or feminists is that we are averse to taking criticism because, well, I can't have done that because you're a woman, because I am a feminist. So it's sort of ironically, I just wanted to point out this observation. I've noticed it's worse among those of us who consider ourselves feminists than those who dismiss feminism.
What I wanted to say is I'm really lucky because my mother was in a Young Lords, which just in the name itself, Young Lords, is a male-dominated name. But if you're a fan of any part of New York City history and you go back and you Google it or you read about it and you learn about it, there were just as many women getting arrested in city colleges all around, and my mom, on videotape, was one of them. And I was lucky to be raised by a strong woman who told me that it wasn't a man's place to make me feel any less valid in my activism, whatever it might be. And I chose ABC in a row and books and bars and militant anti-fascism stuff and various things like that. But she constantly told me and reminded me that I was valid, that my opinions were valid, that whether or not I was being a part of a male-dominated group, that my opinions mattered, and that I was a strong person. And I think that part of us sometimes forget that little girls hear what we're saying. And that we, as women and as men who consider themselves feminists, need to open your mouth and remind these little girls at a young age that whatever it is, whatever their course is, that they're valid. That it doesn't matter how many boys speak louder or raise their hands faster. And I work in education, and I call on just as many girls as I do boys because I've read that study too. You know what I mean? We need to remember that if we want to sit here and gather in a room and say, well, we want to make a difference, start with the little girls that listen to your voice. Let them know that no matter what, that they are important, because that's what did it for me. And I don't let any man take any kind of, you know, give me any shit. And anybody who's been in any collective with me will let you know that I stand my ground. And if I feel like I have something to say, they don't call me loud and listen for nothing. I will stand up and fight it. And that's because my mother instilled that in me. So whatever little girl, you know,
And little boys, too, because they need to hear it, but since this is about women, remind them, because it sticks.
Good afternoon. My name is Gwenda Brown, and I work with the Free Romania Coalition, and I'm glad that I came to this talk. I learned a lot, particularly from your talk, Naomi, and all the rest of you. You girls, women were wonderful. Could everybody hear me? I have a little bit of a cold, so it's kind of aggravating. But anyway. Excuse me?
Maybe turn around.
Oh, okay. Briefly, I just wanted to say I think it is part of our job to raise responsible young men, and I think we do have to call men out when they're doing something incorrectly and they're violating women. I do think it's our responsibility to raise young boys who are respectful of young girls and their mothers, because if we don't do it, they're not going to know. I mean, you just can't assume it. They're going to be like that just because they're going to be like that. That's not the way it is. Excuse me?
Your fathers have to do that too, though, right?
Well, I'm saying, you have to call men out. I don't think, because they're used to being in powerful roles. They're used to taking leadership roles. And I don't think it's something that we could just overlook and say, we shouldn't take that responsibility. They have to realize it themselves. They're not going to realize it themselves. Maybe some of them will. Like this young man back here, he seems to have it together. But some of them, maybe not the majority, but half of them won't. And so that's the only thing that I disagree with you slightly about, Naomi. But the rest of it was really great. I got a lot out of it. And I'm glad to be I was here to hear part of it. And actually, I'm going to leave after this only because I'm sharing a table and I'm supposed to take part of the responsibility to be up there. And if you want to buy bus tickets to Philadelphia, you're welcome to get them. They're only $21. That's my speech about Lumia. And our group is definitely not male-dominated. I haven't had the experiences that, that you, some of us, some of you with girls have had, thank God, but... And I was raised in a single-parent household, and definitely my mother told me, we would never take any back step to anybody, male, woman, white, black, whatever. It's just not done. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Leave some fires.
Oh, okay. Hey, I'm Miranda. First of all, I think that you guys asked a lot of really good questions. I also think that very often women tend to, if like struggles and resistance, tend to take on caretaker roles.
Can you work up more louder?
Women tend to take on caretaker roles even within struggles and resistance rather than taking care of themselves or taking care of each other. And I think that sort of needs to stop. Women need to like respect themselves more and respect men and take care of each other more. I also think that the sort of construction of like the anarchist scene in that it's really male dominated in New York, I think it's a lot because ideas related to anarchism, like in order to get them, you kind of have to have this level of privilege in order to actually come in contact with those ideas. And then, so it's like, New York is a pretty hard city to get buy-in. So the people who actually have the resources that are needed to like start up the anarchist lifestyle and then maintain it is actually more considerable than a lot of anarchists who care to admit. And like, in New York, being that it's a hard place to get by, I think that a lot of times, young white men actually have those resources, being like time and the ability to get by without a job and stuff like that. So I think that those young white men, I mean, it's great that they're doing this, it's like wonderful and inspiring, but I think that they sort of need to like look at how they have been previously spread out their privilege and take these resources which they're able to get and actually see, like, examine critically where they can be put towards. And also I think that Riot Girl really needs to come back.
Unfortunately, we have to go soon, so the floor for, like, asking questions. If you already have a number, then that's great, but after that, if you don't have a number already, sorry, because we have to go soon. So, number five.
Oh, can we pass around an email list or something? If y'all want to continue this conversation or form something, come out of this, that could be a great thing.
Or you're welcome to stick around after the panel's over and talk amongst yourselves, talk to everyone.
Okay, you have number five.
I consider myself to be a feminist since the 70s, and I've seen some things change and obviously some things have not. And it's interesting to hear a young woman talk about not being listened to in a group of men that hasn't changed, not only political situations, but social situations. But general consciousness has changed a lot. I remember when being a feminist was considered something to ridicule. And that's not true anymore. Feminism is considered a legitimate social movement. It's respected. It's the children, girls now take for granted that someday they will have careers, that they can be successful, that they can be assertive, that they don't have to be housewives, they don't have to be nurses and teachers. So that's the positive thing. Also, women have risen to positions of power in the capitalist system. We have a woman, obviously, who was a serious candidate for president. That would have been unthinkable 30 years ago. On the other hand, it's to just be enough, because women are not inherently more virtuous than men. Look at Condoleezza Rice. One of the people who participated in torture in Abu Ghraib was a woman. And I don't like to see men demonized. There are good men, and there are bad men, obviously. But what we need to do is fight the power structure. We need to change society as a whole so that there's justice for everyone, for men and women, for blacks and whites, and for gays and for lesbians.
Thank you. Number six.
Well, kind of what I was going to say, Priya already kind of spoke to you, just because we had something like this last year that you organized, and we said we were going to, like, keep it up and have kind of women's only caucus, and we never did it, but we should. Because I think a lot of the onus, whether we like it or not, does fall on us, on women. Because, yeah, men have to take responsibility, but they also have to be constantly reminded to take responsibility. And, you know, I'm a teacher, so kind of like what you were saying, like, you can't just constantly tell women to be empowered. I think that's important. But, like, my class is all, I only have one girl, and the rest are boys. And my responsibility is reminding my boys to take responsibility constantly. You know, for a million different things, and they get tired of it, but that's okay. So I guess I just wanted to say, like, not only that we need to depend on men to kind of step up, but we need to have full-out solidarity, and we need to follow up on these meetings for real and not just talk about it.
I'm going to lose the meeting. Moving quickly.
So I'm going to make a couple of questions and other questions. I think that it's kind of been agreed and iterated over and over that a completely undue amount of responsibility for combating sexism is calling men out, all the women. And the men need to be accountable for their own shit and work on their own shit and call each other out. But that involves a male space and creating another male-dominated space, and that's really dangerous. And it's not fair for men just to cop out and say, oh, women, what can we do? How can we fight sexism? Give us a solution. Tell us what we can do. That needs to be a discussion among men. But that's, again, another male-dominated space about talking about sexism and women, and that's dangerous. So my question that I would pose, and this is not something that I don't think there's going to be answers for now, but just to pose and talk about in your communities, is how are ways that those conversations can happen and be accountable to women? Because women don't need to be part of that. They don't need to be telling them is, but that those conversations among men about sex need to be held accountable to women in that community. And that's a really complicated thing to arrange and set up, and I don't think you have to do that There's only a few spaces I know of in the country that are specifically male spaces talking about sexism from Denver. And so, yeah, so just think about that. Thanks.
Number 8.
My name's Jim Crutchfield. And I want to tell you all that I'm from the land of powerful women. And hearing my voice, you're going to have preconceptions of who I am and what I think, but I hope we'll disappoint you. I grew up in a female-dominated society. There is patriarchy in the South and in the white South, but it's different from here as far as I can tell. And we have a saying, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. So it's an education for me to live in essentially another country and see how things go down here. Several people have said that it's not women's job to change men, and I don't know that it's anybody's job to do anything, but it seems to me that if you want people to change, most people are pretty satisfied with the way they behave, or they wouldn't behave that way. And if you want them to change, you got to tell them. You got to let them know that it's not satisfactory to you, the way they behave. So give us a break. Nobody taught me to be a dominating male. Nobody came to me on an appointed day and said, okay, Jim, you're a man now. Start letting the women have it. You know, it just doesn't happen that way. These things grow up. And also, I'd like to observe, you know, we've talked about how these bad problems of dominance and disregard for women's contributions and stuff keep getting replicated. And in our activist groups. And that makes me wonder whether we may not be mistaking what the problem is. It may be, it seems to me, that this is not a culturally conditioned thing. This is a natural way for people to behave unless we change ourselves. That we have a default behavior, and we see it throughout history. There's been oppression of women since there have been women and men.
It's not natural.
We can discuss what we're doing right now is not natural. And natural doesn't always mean good. You know, parasites are natural. But I think it would be worth our while to consider whether there might be something else going on here that we need to deal with in a different way besides just talking and telling people what we think.
Johanna?
So I actually just wanted to respond to some things that everyone was saying, which and maybe just post more questions that maybe we can finish with. Maybe I don't know if there's anyone else that has numbers, but I agree with a lot of what has been said about it's not women's job to end sexism because women are not the perpetrators of sexism. Women are not sexist. Maybe they're heterosexist, maybe they're transphobic, but they're not sexist because they don't have the power to be. And so it is men's responsibility, it's the people's responsibility who are sexist to end sexism. I think that women have had the job of educating and fixing women's problems and women's issues, you know, forever and always will, because men and people in power in any given situation don't have a vested interest in losing their power and their privilege. So it's always going to, it's one of the things. I don't know what the answer is, and I don't know what, I don't know. I think that sometimes people want to remove themselves from organizations and work separately, and maybe that, I think that there needs to be a, I guess I'm more interested in knowing how do you deal with that, as women in organizations that are dominated by men, which I don't think there's anything natural about it. I don't think that women shouldn't be aggressive, and I don't think that women should be aggressive. I think women should be able to be themselves and be accepted as they are and bring whatever they're bringing to the table as they are, and they shouldn't have to fit into a mold of what is an activist to bring that, which the default would be male. I don't think they have to, like, speak an activist language, which the default would be male, to do that. I don't think they have to, like, have a, you know, default activist aggression or lack of aggression or any of that. I think we need to value everyone who comes to the table and, like, be able to use everyone's skills and talents. And I don't think we're doing a good job of that. So I guess I'm kind of just more interested in learning more about how do you deal with the bullshit while you're trying to do it, because obviously we care about these things. That's why we're putting ourselves into these situations that frustrate us and, you know, dehumanize us and all that. So how do you deal with it? And yeah, I guess that's mainly my main thing.
Is the email thing still going around? It's kind of important. Thanks.
Make sure it moves.
Number 11 right now. First of all, I'd like to apologize to everyone who I refer to as a number and not a name. I don't know all of you, and I recognize all of your humanity. Basically, what I wanted to say was that the idea that people have power as individuals and people are worthy of existing, worthy of the right to health, worthy of the right to, like, living and being and not being controlled by the state is not necessarily, you know, it's not a white male thing specifically. Intelligence alone, intelligence does not only belong to white men. It does not only belong to, like, people who graduate from college or have a certain amount of privilege. Like, people need to, like, respect themselves as intelligent, respect other people as intelligent, and, like, see that amongst everyone. And I think that, like, what happens sometimes is we see, you know, in the society, in the specifically I'm talking about United States society, we see all these white men in power, and then we are trained subconsciously to defer to white men as they're, you know, seen as, like, more intelligent. And I hear this all the time in the activist community. Oh, well, how do we teach people to be more like us? How do we bring, you know, those people into, you know, helping us, into being like us, into thinking the way we think? And it's like, well, no, that's not what you do. You need to, like, listen to people. You need to respect the fact that people are intelligent, that people are worthy, that people are struggling and striving, whether or not they're, you know, whatever color they are, whatever background they have, like, and whatever level of education they have. You do not need to be a white man who graduated from an Ivy League school or a private college or any college to be important, and I think that's just something to keep in mind to remember. And
can I just quickly add things that are passionate? I think that's very important. Look, what if slaves or black people had said, "Well, we're not being racist, so why should we be the ones to have to eradicate racism?" Unfortunately, it seems like when you are victimized by oppression, the burden unfortunately falls on the victim to really resist. And to speak to your point real quickly, the social conditioning is intense. It starts when you're born. It's a daily, relentless thing about how you're supposed to view women or a person with a different skin color. And in a society where women are constantly and consistently objectified and dehumanized as merely sexual objects for the gratification of men, you know, resisting and thinking differently is not a passive process. It's an active, conscious process, because being passive means you're allowing yourself to be colonized mentally and, you know, emotionally and however, psychologically, by this dominant, exploitative system that wants us to stay divided and mistrustful of each other and not work together effectively. So you can't be passive in reclaiming your consciousness and your revolutionary consciousness. And so it's, yeah. So.
Well, thank you. Thank you.